Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
We're back discussing the Torah portions. This week we're looking at the portion of Shalach Lecha, which goes from Numbers 13:1 through 15:41. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In Shalach Lecha, God sends 12 men of Israel to spy out Canaan in preparation for Israel's entrance into the Promised Land. But when the spies bring back a bad report, Israel rebels against Moses and against God, causing God to sentence Israel to wander in the wilderness for 40 years.
So this portion begins with God telling Moses to send spies out into the land of Canaan. We had read in the last portion that now that it's been a year since the Exodus and they've been at Sinai receiving God's commands, God finally told the people of Israel to set out and head toward the Promised Land. So now, shortly thereafter, they've arrived at the edge of the Promised Land, and God tells them to send men into Canaan to see what the land is like, what the inhabitants are like, how fortified the Canaanites and all the other people groups are, and to see what they'll need to do to conquer Canaan. It specifically says that they send 12 men from each tribe, and they're from the chief families of the tribes. Now, like with the census earlier in Numbers, Levi is not counted, but Joseph gets counted for both of his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So there are two scouts from Joseph, but there are no scouts from Levi. And we see that the spy for the tribe of Ephraim is actually Hoshea, or Hosea, the son of Nun, whom Moses calls Joshua. The Hebrew Hoshea and Yehoshua, which would be Joshua, they're both related to a common Hebrew word which means salvation. And we've seen throughout the Torah so far that Joshua has basically been Moses' right-hand man. He was with Moses as he was coming down from Mount Sinai. He was guarding the tent of meeting and all that. And so he's been with Moses and helping him out a lot. And so now he's one of the 12 guys who's going in to see what the land of Canaan is like.
So these 12 spies go down into the land of Canaan to spy it out. And what they find is that the land is very fruitful. Specifically, it was grape season. So they went and they cut off a cluster of grapes to bring it back to the people of Israel, along with some other fruit from the land, to show the people of Israel this is the fruit that the land produces. But while they're spying the land, they also see the inhabitants of the land. And some of them are the descendants of Anak, and it says that they're giants. So after 40 days, the spies return to the camp of Israel. And they tell them, we scouted out the land. Moses was right. It's flowing with milk and honey, just like God said it would be. But we also saw these really strong people in these fortified cities. And so the spies start to bring this report saying, we can't take this land. The people there are too strong. We cannot overcome them. And this starts to freak the people out. But one of the spies, Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who was the spy from the tribe of Judah, says to the people, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. So you have Caleb and also Joshua with him, telling the people of Israel, this land is fruitful, it's great, let's go and get the land that God is giving to us. But the other 10 spies are bringing a bad report of the land, where they're saying, even though it's fruitful, there's no way we'll be able to take it. We might as well give up now.
So at this point, when all the people of Israel hear the bad report of the 10 spies, they basically break down and they start to turn on God and on Moses. It says that all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. So they're just in tears all night long because the Promised Land is supposedly a really bad place and there's no chance, supposedly, that they can conquer it. And so they, at that point, start grumbling against Moses and Aaron, like we've seen them do multiple times in the desert, starting all the way back in the book of Exodus. And it says, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. Why is Adonai bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. So this is a big deal. They are turning their back on everything that has happened ever since Moses appeared to the people of Israel and started doing the 10 plagues and freeing the people of Israel to be God's people. All of that they are rejecting, and they're also rejecting God's provision for them in the wilderness over this past year. They're saying, we wish we had died because we are going to die. as ridiculous as that is. And now they're also saying, we're going to appoint a new leader, because Moses is their leader, but they're saying, we're going to appoint a leader, and we're going to go back to Egypt, back to the land of slavery.
Yeah, this is not the first time we've seen the people of Israel grumbling by a long shot. It's not even the first time that they've said, it was better for us in Egypt. But this is a step up, because now they're actually getting ready to replace Moses and go back to Egypt. So they're actively taking steps toward rejecting God, rejecting his covenant, rejecting his salvation, and choosing instead their past lives of slavery over the freedom and the promise that is right there.
Mm.
And it's amazing, because God has brought them all this way, and they've sent the spies into the land. They've got the evidence that this land is fruitful, and they have a bad report and a good report before them. All they have to do is choose one. Mm. All they have to do is believe the good report, believe what God said they should see and what witnesses are saying they will see, and just go in, because they're right there. But instead, when all they have to do is believe, they won't believe. When all they have to do is accept God, they are rejecting him. And that immediately starts to undo everything that God has been doing since he brought them out of Egypt.
What the people of Israel are exhibiting here is unbelief and fear. Their fear is undercutting everything that God did, God's salvation and God's provision. These people saw the 10 plagues. They gathered the manna every single day. They heard God's voice rumble from the top of Mount Sinai and give them the Ten Commandments. They know God's power and they know he's real, but they fear what these big people can do. And so because of that fear, they're rejecting everything. Going all the way back to Exodus, we spiritualize the concept of being set free from Egypt and going to the promised land. We likened that to us being set free from sin and going into Yeshua's salvation. In the same way that the Passover lambs died and through their blood, they were safe and they were able to escape from slavery. And then through the narrow pathway of salvation through the Red Sea, they were saved from their past on the other side. In the same way, Yeshua set us free through his blood. He set us free from the slavery to sin and death, from the bondage of our past. And he made us new on the other side so that we can serve him. So what the people of Israel are doing here is akin to, spiritually, us saying, yes, Yeshua, you saved us, your blood redeemed us, but I don't care, I'm afraid. I don't believe anymore, I'm afraid, and I'm going to go back to my old life. It's not simply just slightly veering off the path. It's not stumbling and then getting back on the right way. This is blatant rejection of God's salvation, of God himself, of God's servant, his Messiah. This is rejection of everything. And saying, I would prefer slavery and death to what you have for me. When what God has for us is so much better, it's ridiculous, and it only comes from fear. Fear of what we're seeing now in the present instead of belief for what God will do for us in the future.
So at this point, Moses and Aaron are so desperate, all they can do is fall on their faces in the middle of the congregation. Rather than trying to fight the people of Israel or get them to back down or call God to send fire from heaven or something, Moses and Aaron instead enter this posture of humility and desperation and imploring, just hoping that something will happen to make this stop. Meanwhile, Joshua and Caleb, who spied out the land and who saw what a good land it was, try to combat the bad report that the people of Israel are believing with their own good report. They tear their clothes because they're so grieved at what the people of Israel are doing. And then they say, this land is an exceedingly good land. If Adonai delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against Adonai and do not fear the people of the land. Their protection is removed from them and Adonai is with us. Do not fear them. So Joshua and Caleb are pleading with the people, please don't rebel against God. Don't fear the people. We saw that this land is good. God is fulfilling everything he said he would do. And if God is with us, then why should we fear the Canaanites? Joshua and Caleb know that if God is fighting for Israel, they will win. And they're calling on the people of Israel to remember this.
And to believe it.
But instead, the people's response is to double down in their disbelief. And the entire assembly says to stone Caleb and Joshua with stones. Mm. So not only are they believing the bad report, but they're actively trying to suppress and silence the good report.
Mm.
And the few who are remaining faithful to God are about to be killed.
But it's amazing what we're seeing here, that their fear caused disbelief in God, and their disbelief in God is now causing them to turn to murderous rage. We've seen over and over again, what was the first of the Ten Commandments? I am Adonai your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Israel here is saying, we don't believe that God can follow through and bring us into this land, and we would rather he hadn't brought us out of Egypt. And when they do that, when they reject God and his promises, everything else breaks down. Their entire moral compass is shattered, and they turn to murder. So as the people are planning to murder Caleb and Joshua and replace Moses and Aaron, suddenly God shows up. It says the glory of God appears to the people in the tent of meeting, and he begins to speak to Moses. Basically, God says, how long will these people keep turning against me? How long will these people keep rejecting me and not believing me? After all I've done for them, after all the signs I did in Egypt, after all the signs I did in the wilderness, how long will they keep rejecting me? And then he says, I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you, Moses, into a nation greater and mightier than they. So this is actually something that God has said before. He said this at the golden calf, when again they had rejected God and replaced him with a golden idol. He had said, I'm going to destroy the entire people of Israel and only leave Moses, and then I'll make my promised nation out of Moses, just Moses and his descendants. But we saw that God didn't do that before because Moses reasoned with God and appeased his anger. And so we see again here, Moses desperately appeasing God's anger and trying to reason with him. He again says, what will the other nations say? The Egyptians will hear about this and say, their God wasn't powerful enough to bring them into the promised land. Everyone has seen that you are in the midst of the people of Israel. And so if you destroy all the people of Israel at once, then that will signal to the rest of the nations that you are a God who doesn't fulfill his promises. And then after appealing to God's reputation, he then appeals to God's character. He says, you said to me, you said that you are a God who pardons sin, that you forgive iniquity and transgression, and you're abundant in loving kindness. So prove that now. Prove that by forgiving and pardoning this evil sin that the people of Israel have done.
Moses is hearkening back here to after the golden calf incident, when Moses had gone back up to renew the covenant, and God had declared his name to Moses. And it was then when he declared his name to Moses that he associated his name with being slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness and pardoning iniquity and clearing transgression. And when God had declared that then, it was because he was renewing his faithfulness to the people of Israel, even as they rejected him by making a golden calf. So now Moses is saying, you're the same God who forgave them when they made the golden calf. And if you haven't changed, then forgive them again, as you always have.
And so God says to Moses, I have pardoned them according to your word. As we're going to see in a bit here, God is still going to mete out punishment, just like he did at the golden calf. But he is still pardoning Israel and not giving them what they deserve, which is total, complete destruction. But God says there will still be severe consequences for Israel, and they are still going to die. God passes his sentence on the people of Israel and says that this entire generation who is here at the promised land and they have rejected going in, this entire generation is going to die in the wilderness. Everyone aged 20 years old and up. So everyone that was counted at the beginning of the book of Numbers, the over 603,000 Israelis, every single one of them is going to die in the wilderness, except for Joshua and Caleb, the faithful spies who gave the good report. All the rest of them, their corpses are going to fall in the wilderness as they wander for 40 years. God basically says to them, you said you would rather we had died in the wilderness than go to the promised land. So that's exactly what you're going to get. You're going to die in the wilderness. But unlike how you said your children would be prey for the inhabitants of the land, instead, your children are going to conquer the land. They are going to inherit the promise which you just rejected.
So we see here God saying, He's not going to wipe out the people of Israel so as to destroy Israel, but he is going to kill every single one of those Israelis who rebelled against him, one by one, or 1,000 by 1,000, as we'll see later. But I wanted to use this to point out that God is always faithful to Israel. That is part of who he is, and Moses called on him to remember that, and he did, and he always will. No matter how much Israel rebels against him, he will always keep his promises to Israel, just like he will, as we'll see, bring the people of Israel to the promised land. But none of the people of Israel who rejected him will enter into the promised land. God's faithfulness to the people of Israel does not guarantee every single Israeli the receiving of that promise. Mm. Being born a Jew does not grant you security in the eyes of God. God will always be faithful to Israel, and we as Israel have a purpose. But just because God has specially chosen us for a special purpose doesn't mean we will automatically receive the blessings that come from being Israel. If we rebel against God, the punishment is still death. So on an individual basis, it is our individual job to be faithful to God, to be part of the collective purpose of Israel, which God will always be faithful to fulfill.
And another thing that I wanted to point out is that it also says here, your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. So God is meting out judgment on this entire wicked generation that rejected him. And he's saying that the next generation will get to inherit the land. But in the meantime, they are going to suffer for the unfaithfulness of the current generation. So this just shows that our own sins have lasting effects that affect those around us and those into future generations. God says that even though he does forgive transgressions and iniquities, he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations. So there are consequences to sin that do last for a little while for the other people around them. And so when we are walking in wickedness, we need to remember we aren't the only ones who will get hurt. We are inevitably going to hurt other people. And so that should add more weight on us to avoid rejecting God and walking in sin, because we won't just hurt ourselves. That will hurt other people.
I think if this story emphasizes anything, it emphasizes the importance of belief and the consequences of unbelief. Like I already said, if the people of Israel had just believed what God had said, then they would have gone into the promised land and they would have taken it, and this punishment would have been avoided. But instead, God said to Moses, "How long will this people despise me, and how long will they not believe in me, in spite of all the signs that I have done among them?" And that's the reason that God put this punishment on them, is because they did not believe in God, and so they were despising him. And since they did not believe in God's promise, they did not receive God's promise. The author of Hebrews expounds on this concept using a psalm that talks about this story. As the Ruach HaKodesh says, "Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as in the provocation, in the day of the testing in the desert, in which your fathers tempted me and trying me and saw my actions. For 40 years, therefore, I was grieved with this generation and said, they always go astray in heart, and these have not known my ways. So I swore an oath in my anger, they will not enter into my stopping place." So the psalm itself kind of explains the story we've already read, but then links it to us today, saying, when you hear God's voice, obey it. Don't be hardened and don't have that unbelief. And so going off of this, Hebrews says, "See this, brothers, otherwise there will be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief, resulting in the falling away from the living God. Rather, exhort one another every day while it is called the today, so that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of the sin." So the author of Hebrews is saying that any one of us could be like the Israelites. Any one of us could have unbelief. The people of Israel had walked with God. They had received his words. They had agreed to his covenant. They had seen the presence of God, and his presence was among them. And they had his promises, and they followed him right up to the border, and then they succumbed to unbelief. And instead of receiving the promise, they turned back. And so They didn't enter into the promised land. They didn't receive the promise. And the reason is because they were hardened. They allowed that unbelief. We can fall into unbelief if we allow ourselves to be hardened by the deceitfulness of the sin. Sin can be like the bad spies, the 10 spies who brought a bad report, who deceive us into hardening us into unbelief so that we turn away from the promise and we fall away from God.
This goes all the way back to Adam and Eve back in Genesis. The serpent said to Eve, "Did God really say?" There was a deceit there which caused disbelief in what God had said, and that resulted in the punishment of death.
And so the author of Hebrews goes on to say, "To whom did he swear that they will not enter into his stopping place except to those who did not believe?" And so we see that they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. We should fear then. Otherwise, the promise of entering into a stopping place is being left behind, and any one of you seems to have come short of it. For we also are having good news proclaimed to us, even as they did. But the word they heard did not benefit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard. For we do enter into the stopping place, we who believed. We, as followers of Messiah, have all heard the good news of Yeshua, the good news of what he did for us, how he saved us, and how if we follow him, we can have everlasting life in him. And we've all received that good news. But what the author of Hebrews is saying is that the Israelites in the desert also heard good news. They heard the good news of the promised land. They heard the good report that Caleb and Joshua brought to them. But the good news was useless to them if they did not believe it. Instead, they did not have faith. They had unbelief. And the unbelief prevented them from entering into the promised land. We can be saved through the power of the good news if it is mixed with faith when we hear it. And if we have that faith, if we believe the good news, then we will enter into God's stopping place, God's rest, his everlasting rest and life for us. But that's only if we remain in that faith, if we don't allow ourselves to be hardened by the deceitfulness of the sin and fall into unbelief. And so the author of Hebrews tells us that the solution to this is to exhort one another every day while it is called the today. So there is power in the good news if we believe in it. And in order to remain in that belief, we need to exhort one another. The people of Israel rejected the report that Joshua and Caleb gave and instead became an echo chamber of, "We're going to be killed if we enter into the promised land. Moses and Aaron don't know what they're talking about. It would have been better if we had died in Egypt. Why don't we go back to Egypt?" And so they reinforced one another in that unbelief, in that rebellion. If instead we stand as voices to each other of the truth, reminding each other of the good news that we believe in, and exhorting each other to remain in the faith, to have faith so that we will receive the promise. If we exhort one another in that, then we will help each other to remain in that. And if we remain in that faith, then we will enter into God's promised land for us. We will receive the promise of everlasting life in our Master Yeshua, the Messiah.
There's a reason why the people of Israel didn't believe God. It's because they were afraid of hardship. Every time they grumbled against God and Moses in the wilderness, it was because there was difficulty and stuff was happening that they didn't like. When they heard that there were mighty people in the land of Canaan, they were afraid that they would have to fight them and that there would be hardship and trouble to get to God's promises. The good news of the Master Yeshua is that we will, in the end, have a promised land with God forever, where everything is perfect and it is a land flowing with milk and honey. But God does not promise that we will not face trials along the way. In fact, God almost guarantees that we will face trials along the way. We will be tested. We may have persecution. We may go through personal troubles. We may face tragedy and pain in our lives. But Yeshua says that he who is overcoming is the one who will inherit the promise. The people of Israel didn't overcome. They backed away from the challenge. And so the author of Hebrews is saying we can overcome if we exhort each other to overcome, to meet those challenges and trust that God will be with us through those challenges and get us to a promised land on the other side.
Now, when Moses tells the people of Israel that this is the punishment God is giving them, they immediately do an about face. They're like, oh no, we messed up, we sinned. And they all start mourning. So they realize their mistake. They realize we should have gone into the land when he told us to. We should have believed him. We shouldn't have despised him. We shouldn't have tested him. It reminds me of a stubborn toddler. How it can say, I don't want it until you take it away. And then he's like, oh no, I want it, I want it, I want it. That's what the people of Israel are doing here. Where as soon as Moses says, you won't enter the promised land, they go from saying, we'll never enter the promised land, to please let us enter the promised land. In fact, we're going to go up, we're going to enter right now, we're going to fight the people just like you want us to do, Moses, okay? But Moses' reply is, what God said was that you should have gone into the promised land, but now you won't go into the promised land. God has already issued his punishment. He's not going to change it. Don't go up because God is not going to go with you.
It's too late. You lost your chance.
And so Moses goes ahead and tells them, you could have overcome the Canaanites, but now if you go up, the Canaanites are going to defeat you. So don't try and fight them. Don't go into Canaan. God is not going to be with you when you try to fight when he hasn't commanded. But the people of Israel ignore Moses again. They go into Canaan to try to fight the Canaanites, but Moses and the Ark of God stay in the camp. So the people of Israel leave Moses and leave God behind to try to take the promised land to fulfill God's promise, when God promised that they were all going to die in the wilderness and they were not going to take that land. And so what do you know? The Canaanites totally defeated them. They chased them out. They killed some of them. It was a terrible disaster. And the reason that Israel suffered this defeat is because they tried to fight when God was not with them. They tried to fight against God's command. They tried to fight on their own strength. They should have accepted the consequences of their actions. Sometimes the stupid things we do, the foolish things we do, have bad consequences for ourselves and for others, and sometimes we can't undo that. But it's better to accept the consequences and learn from our mistakes than add on top of our previous mistakes by resisting God and trying to undo the consequences of our mistake on our own strength. Instead, we should always be seeking God's will. We should always be following his word and not doing anything without him. Sometimes we'll mess up, and sometimes there will be consequences for that. But the best thing to do, even when we're facing the consequences of our own actions, is to trust God, to do what God says, knowing that we can overcome when God is fighting with us. But when God doesn't want us to overcome, he won't help us to overcome, and then it's useless to resist his will.
It reminds me of what King Solomon said in Psalm 127, "Unless Adonai builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless Adonai guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain." Anything that we do will be futile if God is not there with us, if we aren't doing it according to God's will and according to God's instructions. And another thing that I want to point out is that the people of Israel were basically picking and choosing the parts of what God said that they wanted to follow. God had said, you are not going to go into the promised land, but they weren't following that. They were just following the part where God said, this is the promised land and you should go and take it. But they ignored what came after that. They ignored God's punishment. And so if we just try to pick and choose the parts of what God says to follow and then ignore the rest, then God will not be with us and we will end up in a world of hurt. So after the portion finishes discussing this whole story where the people of Israel are banished from the promised land for the next 40 years, it then goes on to giving more instructions and commands having to do with offerings and such. It talks about different grain offerings and drink offerings that you offer sometimes, both for native-born and sojourners. And then it moves on to talking generally about intentional and unintentional sins. Basically, it reiterates some of the things that we read back in Leviticus, where if the entire assembly of Israel unintentionally sins, or if an individual person unintentionally sins, then there are specific offerings that they need to give, and then they'll be forgiven. This would be if they were doing something that they didn't know was wrong. So obviously they would have been not familiar with the Torah, and so doing things that violated the Torah without knowing it. In that case, an offering is needed to make atonement, but then after that, you would be forgiven. But then at the end of this section, it specifically says, but the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or a sojourner, that one is blaspheming Adonai, and that person shall be cut off from among his people. Because he has despised the word of Adonai and has broken his commandment, that person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be on him. So as we've read in previous passages in Torah, being cut off from among the people or completely cut off, that's often tied with the death penalty or being cut off from the land of the living. This is a severe, severe punishment. If you're intentionally going against God's word, then any Israelite who does that, whether native or sojourner, they get cut off. So this is very different from just slipping up and needing to give an offering. This is intentionally saying, I know what God says. I don't care what God says. I don't care about God. You're blaspheming Adonai is what it says. And so then you're acting against God's Torah on purpose. Any Jew who does that is deserving of being cut off from the whole people of Israel.
I think this goes in line with some things that we've said in a previous portion about the sacrificial system and its relation to the covenant. How when the people of Israel forsake the covenant, it breaks down, including the sacrificial system. God gave the sin offerings to make atonement for the people of Israel whenever they sin, as long as these are people who are still seeking God. Everybody makes mistakes, and God gave the sacrificial system as a provision for that. But when the people of Israel forsake God's covenant, when they forsake God, this covenant breaks down because this covenant has no sacrifice for intentionally rejecting God, for intentionally rejecting his commands and his covenant. And I think this points to how we needed a better covenant, a better sacrifice from a better Savior, Yeshua, who loved us even when we were sinners and who reconciled us when we were enemies of God. This covenant provides for the mistakes of those who are seeking God. But Yeshua came to save those who had made themselves enemies of God, who were in rebellion against him. And Yeshua offered a path of reconciliation for that. And that makes Yeshua the only solution to when this covenant in the Torah is broken. This covenant cannot repair itself because it has no offering for the defiance of the people of Israel. But Yeshua can reconcile those who are defiant against God. Yeshua can bring them back. And so, for the people of Israel, he is the restorer of this covenant between God and Israel.
Now, one other thing that I want to bring up about this passage is that it's specifically saying that if you are going against the covenant that God has already established with you, if you're intentionally throwing that away by doing willful sin, then you need to be cut off. And this reminds me of what Hebrews 10 says. For if we keep willfully sinning after the receiving of the full knowledge of the truth, then there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain kind of fearful expectation of judgment and fiery zeal about to devour the opposers. Anyone who has made a Torah of Moshe as nothing dies apart from compassion by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much sorer punishment then will he be counted worthy, he who trampled on the Son of God and counted as a common thing the blood of the breach, the blood of the covenant in which he was set apart, and brought insult to the Ruach, the spirit of the unmerited favor. So the language here is very similar. It's talking about if after we know the truth, full knowledge of the truth, and we know God, and we've accepted Yeshua's sacrifice, and his blood has already set us apart, if we are already in the covenant, and then after that, we keep willfully sinning, going against what we already know, then there's no longer a sacrifice for sins. As the author of Hebrews says here, casting away the Torah of Moses, casting away that covenant has a really bad punishment, the punishment of death. So if we have accepted Yeshua's sacrifice and then we cast that away, how much greater of a punishment will that be? It's a greater covenant and it brings greater redemption. So the punishment for rejecting it is also greater. And so this is why right before this, the author of Hebrews says, and let us consider how to provoke one another to love and to good actions, not forsaking the gathering of ourselves together, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day coming near. Like Hosea quoted earlier from Hebrews 3, The concept here is that we need to exhort one another. We need to provoke one another to love and good actions. That's why we need to seek fellowship with other believers, is so that they can keep us in check, so that they can keep us on the path and keep us from falling into unbelief and willful sin. Not stumbling. Stumbling is bad, and we should repent for that. But willful sin and rejecting God, any of us can fall into it if we aren't exhorted and we don't remain strong in the faith. So the author of Hebrews here is warning us, stay on the path. Don't forsake the blood of the covenant. Don't forsake the gathering with other believers, but provoke each other. Be involved in each other's lives. Don't hold each other at arm's length, but exhort one another so that we can all inherit the promise of the covenant.
So next we read that during one Shabbat, during the people of Israel's wandering in the wilderness, they find a man who's gathering wood on the Shabbat day. Most translations say sticks here, but the Hebrew word is actually the word for tree. So he's gathering big pieces of wood. And so when the people find him, they're like, oh no, looks like he's breaking the Shabbat. And so they put him in custody and they ask Moses and Aaron, what do we do with him? Now we had already read previously that the punishment for a Jew breaking the Shabbat is death in Israel. And so that's exactly what God told Moses here. He said, put him to death. Let all the congregation stone him with stones. Mm. And so Moses tells that to the people, and the people stone the Shabbat breaker.
So this story here basically implies what is said explicitly in the prophet Jeremiah, which is that it is forbidden to carry a burden or a load on Shabbat. We had already read previously that Shabbat is a day for resting, for not working. And so here we see it's also a day for not doing anything laborious. Anything that is contrary to that spirit of restfulness, of stopping what you're doing, of being still on God's holy day, that is against Shabbat. And so it's forbidden for a Jew to do it. Additionally, this guy was specifically collecting logs. And I can't think of very many reasons to collect logs, but one of the main ones would be if you want to start a fire with it. We'd also read previously that kindling a fire is forbidden on Shabbat. So again, whether it's the carrying the burden or if he was planning to kindle a fire with this guy was definitely in violation of the Shabbat. And the Shabbat is one of the Ten Commandments for the people of Israel, so he had to be cut off from the people of Israel. Finally, this portion wraps up by giving one more command about something that's called tzitzit. In most translations, tzitzit will be rendered as tassels or fringes. But basically, they would be long, they would be tassels, and you're supposed to have them on the edge of your garment. The edge of the garment is called the kanaf. And so that's basically, they would have their garments, and at the edge, that's where they would have all their tzitzit. Now, interestingly, there's another command that's very similar in Deuteronomy, which says that on the kanaf of your garment, you're also supposed to have something that's called gedilim, which is usually also translated as tassels or fringes, but it's more of a festoony type thing that would just go around the edge of the garment. So on the edge of Israeli garments, you're supposed to have both of these, both the tzitzit and the gedilim, and it's supposed to go all around the edge of the garment. So tzitzit is specifically for garments, and it's supposed to be a part of the garment. You're supposed to make it on the kanaf of your garment. So it's not a separate thing that you would attach to a garment. It's part of the edge, part of the hem of your garment. So Jews are supposed to have specific clothing that has these tzitzit and gedilim built into it. And specifically here with the tzitzit in Numbers, it says that it's supposed to be on the kanaf of the garment, which goes around the whole base of the garment. So it's not just on the corners, it's around the whole thing. So in modern Judaism, their fulfillment of this command of having the tzitzit and the gedilim is found in what's called a talit or a tallis, and it's a Jewish prayer shawl which has some of these features on the edges of the cloth. Additionally, they have what's called a talit katan, which you would actually wear under your clothes, and it would have the tzitzit and the gedilim. The main problems with these are namely that the tzitzit doesn't go all the way around the kanaf of it. It's just one on each corner. And additionally, it's not really a normal garment of clothing. Either you only use it during prayer, or if you're wearing a talit katan, you barely even see it usually. And in that case, that kind of defeats the point, as we'll see here in this passage a little bit later.
Now, God then goes on to say the reason why the people of Israel are supposed to wear tzitzit on their garments. And it shall be tzitzit for you to look at and remember all the commandments of Adonai to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. So you shall remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your God. Mm. So like a lot of the other commandments that God's already given Israel, it's supposed to be a way for the people of Israel to be holy for God. But more than that, tzitzit serve as a tangible, visible sign of that holiness and of God's commandments. When the people of Israel have tzitzit on their normal daily garments, they can't go a single day without seeing the tzitzit. And every time they see them, they're supposed to remember the commandments of God. Every time an Israeli sees the tzitzit on his garments, he's supposed to say, why do I have these tzitzit on my garment? Because God commanded it. Because God wants me to be holy, and God gave me the Torah, and God wants me to follow his way and obey his commands and not do what I want to do, not follow my own heart and my own eyes and go astray from him. And so this is a really good point, that the tzitzit are to remind the people of Israel of this distinction between God's commands and following your heart. So many people believe that it's best to follow your heart, to live based on what you want to do, to follow your feelings and your emotions and the things that you see and your desires, and let that dictate your behavior. But God is saying, don't do that. Don't follow your heart. Don't do what you want to do. Do what God commands. Mm. Because when you follow your heart, you end up going astray. You end up going with whatever you see, whatever you feel, with every whim, you stray further away from God. Mm. If you want to follow God, if you want to be holy for him, then you have to stick to his commandments. And if you set your heart on God's commands, then when you follow his commands, you won't go astray.
I'm reminded of what Paul says in Galatians 5, where he basically says that the flesh and the spirit are opposed to one another. The flesh represents our own physical desires, our lusts, our passions, the things that we want to do, basically along the lines of what God says about following after your own heart, versus the spirit is God living in us. It's God's will and his voice of what we should be doing. And Paul says that the flesh and the spirit are opposed to one another, such that the things that we want, these you may not do. Paul lists a bunch of the actions of the flesh and says that those doing such things will not inherit the reign of God. But then he lists the fruit of the Spirit, which many of us know: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, humility, and self-control. There is no Torah against such things. So if we are walking in our own desires, if we follow after the things that we want, then we will be opposed to God's Spirit, and we won't do what he wants. But if instead of doing the things that we want, we follow after the Spirit and we walk in the Spirit, then we will have life. We will have all the fruit of the Spirit, which are good and righteous and honorable things, and there's no Torah against any of those. In other words, if we're walking in the Spirit, then that's the best way to fulfill the spirit of the Torah.
So I think the big takeaway from this portion is, don't be hardened against God's voice, his will, and his word. The people of Israel were given God's promise and a good report of the land that God was bringing them to. And all they had to do was obey God's voice to go in and take the land. Mm. But instead, they were hard against him because of their unbelief, and they resisted his will, and they refused to go in. And because of that, they brought punishment on themselves. And they tried to correct that punishment by being hard to it. Mm. They refused to accept the consequences of their actions and continued to resist God's will at the cost of their own lives by going in and fighting the Canaanites. God is always with us when we are following him. Even when we stumble, even when we make mistakes, if we are relying on him, he will continue to lead us. If we are being pliable to his voice, if we are following his will, and when we mess up, if we immediately seek to get back on track by saying, what do you want me to do, God? What does your word say I should do? Mm. But if we resist God's will, he doesn't provide for that. He's not going to be with us when we are actively resisting him. So we should always be seeking God's will and exhorting one another to remain in God's will, to remain in His word, no matter what hardships we face, no matter what consequences of our own actions we face, to always be remembering God's words, not following our own heart, but only what God's heart is for us.
That wraps up the portion of Shalach Lecha. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Korach, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.